All right, hey there, this is Bram Kanstein and you're listening to Bitcoin for Millennials. In this episode, I'm joined by John, aka Last Coin Standing. He's an avid Bitcoiner and educator focused on Bitcoin's second order effects. He's a product management leader at MasterCard with 20 years of experience in consumer internet and financial services. And John writes extensively on Bitcoin, particularly exploring how loyalty and merchant offers can drive Bitcoin's usage as a medium of exchange. He has a strong background in user research, metrics, and business strategy, and is an advisor to SatSpec, a European Bitcoin rewards company. Welcome, John. I'm super excited to have you on.
Thanks, Bram. Happy to be here. I should just mention, I left MasterCard last month, so I'm not still there.
Maybe we'll get to that. Is Bitcoin the reason?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, very keen to focus on Bitcoin-related stuff. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, you know, I don't want to guess your age, but I will assume you are a Gen Xer. Like, how do you experience talking about Bitcoin with your generational peers?
Yeah, I'd say it's mixed. I'd say there's definitely a very small subset of my friends and family, immediate family and extended family, who have an interest in Bitcoin. Most they're not so interested. And I definitely see more of an interest from the younger generations. I certainly have managed to orange pill a handful of my close friends though, and family, because you know, we spend a lot of time together, and they're willing to put up with me talking about Bitcoin for longer than most people.
Yeah. So how did that go? Was it a big challenge, or what was your angle there?
Sure. I think it's a big challenge. Like, just like anything, I think you have to start with the problem. You have to recognize that there's a problem before talking about the solution. And I think that many people, actually, it's kind of come up in the last year or so, but we used to try and orange pill people by getting people to buy Bitcoin. But I think the much smarter approach now is to focus on getting them to learn about Bitcoin, and more fundamentally to learn about money. What is money? Because I think if you don't understand the question, what is money, you can never really get to the point where it's like Bitcoin is very much a kind of a second order from that foundational understanding of what is money and why our current money is broken. And once you know it's broken, then you can start looking for a solution to that. And Bitcoin very much is the solution. And in my mind, it's the only solution.
Yeah. And I also wanted to ask, like, did you ever talk about Bitcoin with your colleagues? Like, wink, wink.
I did. I talked with them. I mean, certainly some of my close colleagues at MasterCard I've had conversations with. And I think it's funny as well, because my laptop in meetings is covered with Bitcoin stickers. And of course, it's the only one like that. And I do mention Bitcoin from time to time in meetings. But I think, like a lot of legacy traditional might be the more benign name, but like a lot of legacy or traditional financial institutions, I think for better or for worse, they don't really have much of a role to play in Bitcoin. And I think it's very difficult to reimagine any component of their business model to have a successful Bitcoin strategy, for better or for worse. I think a lot of these institutions are very much tied to the fiat system. So I think that's a challenge. And I think it's one of the reasons I've been, like, I'm a Bitcoin maximalist class of 2017. So I've worked at MasterCard the last 10 years. But I think now that I'm no longer at MasterCard, I'm sort of in a better position to focus more on Bitcoin-related stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll get to, you know, MasterCard and financial incumbents. I'd love to talk about that, like what your view is on that. Well, you said Bitcoin class of 2016.
2017.
So how did you encounter Bitcoin? And, you know, obviously, operating in a TradFi world, were there any like beliefs that held you back in understanding it when you first encountered
it? I think the biggest impediment that I had is that, unfortunately, I have a degree in economics. So I have a degree in business and economics from Trinity College Dublin. I grew up in Dublin, Ireland. And that was very much a liability, because you're sort of mired in all these Keynesian ideas and modern monetary theory that we certainly never learned what money is from first principles. And like I touched on earlier, that is really the foundation by which you start to appreciate why Bitcoin is really interesting and a solution to a very big problem. The first memory I have of encountering Bitcoin that I have as a memory was around 2012 or 2013, where I remember I was in Palo Alto, California. I live in California now. And I was with my close friend, Nick, and he pointed out that like, oh, this coffee shop takes Bitcoin. They support Bitcoin. And I remember just rolling my eyes and quickly changing the conversation to something else, because in my mind, I just assumed Bitcoin was some fad or some gimmick or some monopoly money. And I had no time for it. And I think there's another saying in Bitcoin that we sort of have to be tapped on the shoulder about three times or have three contacts with Bitcoin before we start asking those extra questions and start getting more curious. Unfortunately, I didn't take it seriously. But I think one thing I have, and I think many Bitcoiners have, if not all Bitcoiners have, is that we do have an intellectual curiosity. So at some point, and in my case, it was around 2017, I started to ask more and more questions, because I guess it was probably the price. I noticed that earlier in the year, Bitcoin was at about $1,000. And then by about, I think, March or April, it was at about $3,000. So that was very interesting. And at the time, also, unfortunately, there was a lot of like altcoin stuff going around. And I remember just sitting down and starting to just go on that sort of intellectual curiosity journey to learn more. So, and of course, then it's, as we all know, it's a rabbit hole. The more questions we get answered, the more additional questions we have. And it's just so intellectually stimulating that I think a lot of us just keep going, and it's a never ending journey. And it's a wonderful journey.
Hey there. I want to ask you for a quick favor. I noticed something interesting. 75% of my viewers aren't subscribed yet. Subscribing helps me grow this channel, ensuring more great content each week. So if you're enjoying our conversations on Bitcoin for Millennials, please consider hitting the subscribe button on YouTube or the follow button on your favorite podcasting app. I'm super grateful for everyone who already joined and shared their thoughts. Your feedback really keeps me going, and I want to ask you to continue doing that. I try to respond to all the comments and also the emails that I get, and DMs on Twitter, etc. So don't stop doing that. I'll keep going. Now let's get back to the conversation. I think it's so interesting when you say like, and you probably look at it differently now, right? But then like your friend points out like, hey, this store takes Bitcoin, and you just roll your eyes. It's probably the opposite of how you look at the world now, or how you sure. think, right?
Like, absolutely.
What do you think that is? Because like, if I would have to translate it, especially like I also have TradFi experience at two big banks, right? Like, but fortunately I was already in Bitcoin. So I kind of saw it already, but I can imagine for you, like as a career in this, right? You see this and you roll your eyes. It is hubris in a sense, right? Like, what do these geeks know or whatever, right? Well, where maybe now you would see it more as a signal, like, oh, it's interesting that someone accepts something different than dollars, for example. Why is that, right? And then you trigger yourself into learning. But yeah.
Yeah, I think I touch on this notion in one of my writings, the Bitcoin Migration, around, I think it's one of the books by Malcolm Gladwell, Blink, where us human beings, we often dismiss things, and it's a kind of a good natural behavior, because a lot of things, like we have to focus our attention on certain things, and Bitcoin to me at that time just didn't seem worthy of my attention. And of course, there's an opportunity cost to that attention. So it means that you're focused on other things that you think are more important going on at the time. So I think that's the sort of rationale. I think Saylor echoes this point as well, where when he first encountered Bitcoin, and for many years subsequently, he didn't really focus much on Bitcoin, because there wasn't a particular problem going on in his business that warranted his attention on Bitcoin, because he sort of assumed that inflation was 2% and that's just fine and you just deal with that. But once he realized it was much more than 2%, then he realized it was a problem, and that was a problem that needed a solution. And that's when you start to pay a bit more attention, that when it, like Bitcoin is one of those things in your list of things to check out. And then you start to pay more attention and you start to dig deeper.
Yeah. So when you started paying attention, you were probably full on in like the ICO wave also with all the trash. Like, what made Bitcoin click for you eventually? I mean, a lot of people say you have to shitcoin before you Bitcoin, right?
Like, yeah, I think that's very true. And unfortunately, that was my case as well. I think it's, this also gets back to sort of basic human intuition, where when I encountered Bitcoin, I start to position it in my brain relative to other things, not just traditional finance, but other crypto assets, as we say. And I start to categorize Bitcoin alongside other things. So my assumption was at the time was like, oh, Bitcoin is this large or first successful crypto asset, but there are these other things. And so Bitcoin is part of this larger universe. And I think 9 times out of 10, that sort of thinking is logical and it makes sense and it's very helpful. But unfortunately, Bitcoin is that 1 time out of 10 where it's a complete waste of time. And you can spend your 1,000 hours exploring altcoins, but it will really not yield any insight. And I think I made a mistake of reading that book, Crypto Assets by Chris Bernsky, which also unfortunately seemed very logical, like, oh, there's crypto tokens and there's crypto utilities and there's crypto platforms. But ultimately, I recognize that Bitcoin is attempting to be the new global money. And that use case is somewhere between 300 and 800 billion, 800 trillion. And that's really, and it's a money, it's a winner take all scenario. And so it took me a while to realize that Bitcoin is the most interesting problem in this whole space. And I even wonder if there is any space beyond Bitcoin. I think the only other asset that I think plays a role right now that I think is sustainable into the medium term is perhaps stablecoins. I mean, fiat stablecoins, mm-hmm. they're, for better or for worse, they're still useful in this fiat-denominated world. But I think money is something that converges on one ultimately. And I think a second-best money in the grand scheme of things really has no role to play over the long term.
Yeah. Well, so that obviously takes some time to understand, right?
It does.
I mean, for me, I think it was the same, like the entire technology dimension, right? Like if you look at it just from a technology perspective and something comes along that says, you know, this is faster or, you know, whatever, you'll be like, oh, faster is better, right? Like this is a better mousetrap. I'm going to follow that one.
Right.
Like, you know, so that takes some time, obviously. Like, were there any things that you learned or took from your experience working at MasterCard that helped you in understanding that this was the only thing, or was it more a burden?
Yeah, I don't think so, to be honest. I think it comes back to so one of the things I did is I read a couple of books on money, and that was very useful as a foundation. And in fact, one book I recommend that I got a lot of use out of, if I were to pick one, it's Money, the Unauthorized Biography by Felix Martin. I found that very useful. And it's not a book I hear much from Bitcoin circles. But it's really then starting from that foundation, I realized that looking at all of the key attributes or characteristics of what make an ideal money, it was a really profound experience to realize how Bitcoin really satisfied all of these criteria in a way that no money ever has. And maybe it's worth touching on a few of those because I do think they are interesting. I mean, money is really a ledger, like a ledger of economic energy or monetary energy. And that's all it is. It's very foundational. And certainly when we think of the characteristics that make an ideal money, I think absolute, the concept of scarcity is very important. I think that's the sort of cornerstone of a good money. And certainly that's why we see certain monies like gold take a very significant role over the last several thousand years. But then, of course, with Bitcoin, we have the concept of absolute scarcity, which is something that has never existed before. And taking it further, like it's almost two separate points, is the concept of then digital absolute scarcity. Because even if you had, say, some magical gold that was absolutely scarce and you couldn't mine any more gold, it still would be somewhat impractical for global trade in the modern world where everything works on internet time and so forth. So the fact that it's not just absolutely scarce, but it's digitally scarce or digitally conservative. That's also a first in the human race that is really profound. And I think Saylor has talked a lot about that. Another concept is the fact that Bitcoin has no issuer. And this is, of course, a problem with all these other altcoins that come around because they do have an issuer. They're pre-mined. They have a team working on them. And Bitcoin really stands alone in that. It has no issuer. It's the first true commodity money. It's the first bearer instrument over distance. So this is a difference with fiat money, where really when I send money to a friend on the other side of the world, it's just a exchange of a promise or an IOU. It's not a final settlement in real time. And even when you have like dollars or euros in your hand, it's really not a bearer instrument. It's just a kind of a funny money. It's more better described as a nation state plaything in a way than what has been the concept of money over millennia.
Could we zoom in on that a little bit? Because obviously, you know, lots of people say like, oh, Bitcoin can't be money because it doesn't have enough transactions. Something like MasterCard has this and that many transactions, right? Sure. But I think the understanding of final settlement is super important here, right?
Absolutely.
If Bitcoin is a base layer for money, I don't know who said this. I saw a talk by a guy who said like Bitcoin is layer one and layer zero is the mining, right? The layer zero, sure, the mining where it's created. And you have layer one of the network.
Yeah.
And then on top of that,
other layers
will be built.
Sure.
Right. Yeah, but layer zero is the, sorry, wait, layer zero is the final settlement, right? Because if you build on top of that, you have to follow the rules, right? But if people compare it to MasterCard, which is probably like a layer seven or something, right, sure, in the fiat world, like can you explain that a bit?
Yeah, I think I think it's an interesting concept to think of layer zero as mining and maybe layer one as the settlement layer. And then layer two, I think, is probably well described as the payments layer. And then maybe layer three beyond that is more like, I guess, secondary payments layers, payment layers. I think like really when we're trading, when we have I don't want to pick on MasterCard, it could be Visa or American Express or any credit card transaction or debit card transaction, that really there is not final settlement. And this has implications for both the merchant side and the consumer side, but in particular the merchant side. Because then you have concepts of like chargebacks or fraud that are very expensive and have very significant material cost. And most consumers don't really think that they're paying for those costs, but of course they are paying for them in an indirect way.
The surface fee.
And of course,
right.
Yeah, absolutely. There, of course, there's fees with credit card, you know, 3% and so forth. So in fact, it's one of the very significant tenets of what it really drives me over the net and has really made me think about focusing on Bitcoin full time and working on Bitcoin full time, is that with my experience and expertise at MasterCard, in particular in card linked offers, which I work on, merchant offers, that it opens up significant opportunities that in Bitcoin that are not available to the fiat infrastructure. This concept of final settlement in real time and users getting their rewards or redemption in real time, and both suppliers and partners getting the opportunity to be paid in real time. It's a real strange concept, because we deal in fiat world, we deal with this concept of 30 days, 60 days, that every time you make transactions, that there's sort of a delay between when you have to receive payment. So all of those things go away. And, you know, the concept of chargebacks and fraud also disappear, which is very powerful. So if there's one thing I would I think the concept of medium of exchange in Bitcoin is often dismissed, or it's relegated to some secondary role that's going to happen down the line after a store of value is sort of a use case that is fully occupied. But what I think a very important insight I find with Bitcoin as medium of exchange is that it's undeniable that it strips significant costs out of the system. And that is a huge factor that is underappreciated. So for merchants who do have the take the opportunity to open up a Bitcoin channel and to move some of their business to that channel, they're literally getting a significant competitive advantage versus their peers in their vertical. So that's a huge benefit. And one other related benefit I will say is that it's those benefits are completely independent of the Bitcoin price. It's not dependent on the Bitcoin going up in price. So certainly there are very good additional benefits, which I hope to write about very, very shortly, of course, about having a treasury strategy to complement the merchant's operational strategy. But even if the merchant didn't even like Bitcoin, didn't believe in Bitcoin, and converted all of its Bitcoin receipts to fiat at the point of sale, they would still be stripping out significant costs from their operations. So that is a huge benefit.
Yeah. So what's your view on, well, you just mentioned it before, but like the adoption of Bitcoin by incumbents like MasterCard or any other financial giant? You just said in the beginning, like they don't really have a role to play.
Yeah.
I find that super interesting. You know, they are this layer seven. Like, how are they gonna come down, or build for transparency, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple of articles I hope to write soon on Bitcoin blue ocean strategy and counterpositioning, which I think will help answer some of those questions. But I think the most important insight, I think, related to the question that you answered is really recognizing that Bitcoin is a parallel system. It can live alongside the fiat system, and it can have interconnections. Like we see that with the Bitcoin exchanges. You know, it's a big business where you're exchanging fiat for Bitcoin. But that's really the level of interoperability. And I think over the long term, I mean, my thesis is very much that Bitcoin becomes global money over a long enough timeline. And there is no role for fiat. And I know that people like Saylor have said otherwise, but I think that's maybe a separate conversation. But I think, like I touched on earlier, I think there is ultimately no role for a secondary money, because the benefits to having a global universal language of value is just a much better future than any future that has an ideal money and for some strange reason some secondary money lives alongside. I think that universal language of value is the more likely destination that we're moving to.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe for like day to day, I also don't know what it's going to look like, but it could be like if there is a new form of fiat-ish type money, like a new currency backed by Bitcoin, for example, then I could see those two things, you know, exist together. But that could very well be, by the way, like a USD stablecoin. Although those are obviously created by companies. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting kind of side conversation as well. The concept, I do hear that concept a lot, backed by. For me, it doesn't hold water to the extent that...
Back to that, basically, right?
Yeah, I mean, the nice thing about Bitcoin is that it is a bearer asset. It is a bearer instrument with no counterparty risk. And I think as we get into second layers like Lightning or eCash, and federated solutions, then you could argue, I mean, those have their own potential points of failure in that. But I think those will always be better than some institution that is claiming that the money is backed by Bitcoin, because we've seen countless scenarios through history where that concept of backed by was a promise that was broken. Like in 1971, where the US dollar went off the gold standard, or officially went off the gold standard, and you know, times like 1934, where we had the 6102 rule, where you had the kind of gold seizure and so forth. So I think those promises from the government are backed by, I think, will always be trumped by just having a bearer instrument. I mean, the wonderful thing about when you hold Bitcoin is that you hold a slice of the pie, if you will, that, and that slice remains exactly the same for the rest of eternity, which is very powerful. And whereas I think for any other money that is backed by, I think in 100 years time, there are risks, potentially significant risks, that you would not have your money anymore and it would no longer be backed by.
Yeah, I agree. That's probably more more probable. You sent me some articles. I read one really long one, but I really liked it. It's called The Bitcoin Migration. And here you also touch upon, you know, the importance of absolute scarcity in Bitcoin. How does that contrast with, you know, gold and fiat money, and why is it crucial for a new or ideal money system?
Yeah, I think if we look back in the history of monies, and we start with monies like, say, there is monies like beads and seashells and feathers, and we almost laugh at the concept of those being money, but really they were the best money for their period in time, in their place in time. And nobody, even the smartest people in the world at that time, didn't have any better idea of what would make the ideal money. So I think then precious metals came along, and they were stronger in that very one regard, scarcity, that made them quite resilient as monies over time. And I think the couple, or like the two or three maybe limitations with gold, is that, of course, it does have an inflation rate of about, you know, between 1% and 2%, so it's not absolutely scarce. And I think it has like a half life in terms of purchasing power of maybe 35 years, something like that. And then it tends to be centralized, because from a practicality standpoint, it tends to be located mainly with banks and so forth, and that provides a potential point of failure, and that gets back to the 6102 law in I think it was 1934, where FDR did the seizure of gold, or the repricing of gold. And then maybe there's a third one, of course, where gold is really impractical as a bearer instrument for trade over distance. So while it's very useful as a money over time, across distance, it has limitations. I think fiat went through, you could argue, a kind of a honeymoon period, where we did start to use fiat as sort of proxies for gold, because it sort of overcame that limitation around trade over distance. So then you had a period where you kind of had your cake but could eat it too, where you had what was a bearer instrument, or at least appeared to be a bearer instrument, and you could redeem it at a bank for the full gold value. It was paper gold that you could trade over distance and transport very easily and so forth. And then, of course, we sort of broke away from that sort of second stage, where now it's no longer exchangeable for gold. So, which, you know, really brings us to fiat money, which is quite broken in so many ways. I think with Bitcoin now, for the first time, we have scarcity that is a very special type of scarcity, not just credibly scarce, but absolutely scarce and digital, which I touched on earlier, which is really profound and really makes Bitcoin very versatile for global trade, given its digital nature and so forth, especially on second layers, of course. But also, we have very high confidence that like 100 years from now, even 1,000 years from now, there will not be any more Bitcoin. So that when you do carve out your Bitcoin position now, you can be confident that you will have that very same share or position even like 1,000 years from now, which is pretty profound and pretty incredible. And we have never had a money like that. So recognizing that scarcity is arguably the most important quality of the money, and then recognizing that Bitcoin solves that in a way that has never been solved before, and really solves it. You know, arguably it's not perfect, because there's definitely scalability challenges still to be overcome and privacy also solutions, more solutions that have to come. But they can come on second layers. And I think there's always progress being made there. So,
I would argue the same. I think the scarcity dimension or the characteristic of Bitcoin is where all the other value actually is derived from, not the value in terms of the price, but as to what it is, because if it's provable finite scarcity, you know, then transparency comes from that, right? Because I can say I have Bitcoin, but then you can say, well, prove it to me, and then I have to, right? There's no way around that, for example. So yeah, I agree with that. Like, are there any other like unique or less discussed characteristics that make it stand out that are not that mentioned a lot? Like for you?
Yeah, there are a few, I think. I think another one that's not discussed as much as it should be is the fact that Bitcoin is neutral or non-sovereign. So if you look at, say, reserve currency histories over the years, I think we started maybe with Portugal, and then it was Spain, and then it was Netherlands, I think, and then France, and then the UK, and now the USA. So we go through these sort of 80-year periods where we have global reserve currency. But of course, when you look at that history, and in fact, even when you go earlier than that, and you go back to monies like the Roman denarius or the florin, which is a very successful currency that lasted for about 400 years and arguably was a significant catalyst for the Renaissance in Italy. Even those had nation state affiliations and were therefore thereby also ultimately corrupted, and ultimately, whether it's they were debased with other metals or coin clipped and so forth. But yet now with Bitcoin, for the first time, arguably, we have a neutral money, like a really truly neutral money, because even when you think of those gold pieces, they had nation state affiliation to some extent. But Bitcoin is truly neutral and non-sovereign. The other thing that I found is very interesting is that Bitcoin is kind of global and borderless. So from a financial state standpoint, from a financial trade standpoint, when you think of the world now, we sort of take for granted that if you're importing things from other countries, there's foreign exchange fees and there's import fees and so forth. So I think one of the implications of Bitcoin is I think it's going to bring the world closer together, because it will overcome those fees, and you can have a truly borderless transaction in a way that you never could have before. I think what's also interesting is the fact that Bitcoin is really organic versus imposed. Like fiat currency really was very much imposed by nation states. It's not a natural money. It's arguably not. In some ways, you can make a very good argument that doesn't fit the criteria of really what is money. And that's why I sometimes refer to it as a kind of a nation state plaything, because it is imposed. Whereas all other monies throughout history were sort of driven in a kind of a grassroots way or organically from the people, and people chose those monies. So Bitcoin very much falls into that. And I think what's also interesting about Bitcoin as well is that we don't have to convince our politicians to adopt Bitcoin. I mean, certainly that will help. And I think there are good efforts underway to try and do some of that work. But we ourselves as individuals and companies can government and governments can adopt Bitcoin separately, independently by ourselves. And many of us have. So that's another sort of aspect to it that is interesting. Yeah. I think the fact also that Bitcoin is very much peer-to-peer, that there are no gatekeepers in the middle. I mean, and that's something that we increasingly recognize in the fiat world. We have cases recently, like I know the war in Ukraine, where Russian assets have been frozen. And really, not to say that that's a good thing or a bad thing, but just to recognize that that kind of thing can happen really shows that fiat money is very much permissioned. And similar to what happened with the Canadian truckers and that. I think another factor is that Bitcoin is very inclusive. So when you think, like, there's something like 4 billion people in the world out of the 8 billion that are either unbanked or underbanked. And many of those people can't even get a bank account. And even if they do, they have to go through KYC and AML and so forth. And And it's just very onerous. And many of them, especially some of the poorest people in the poorest parts of the world, are unable to do that. So Bitcoin is the really great, great leveler. And it's very inclusive, which I think is a very powerful idea. So it, for the first time, like many people in parts of the world can start to save in a way that they could never save before. So it's very, yeah, very powerful. I think maybe finally is that Bitcoin is like private property on steroids, because you now have private property that you can walk across a border. You can go on vacation and it's a one-way vacation and never come back. And so the fact that you can do that is very interesting, that we've never had that before, really. And I think one of the implications of that is that we will start to see more capital flight, or threat of capital flight, in a way that it will help make governments more responsible in a way, because if they do start trying to tax Bitcoin, they'll likely find that a lot of Bitcoiners will just move abroad or move to more benign Bitcoin-friendly jurisdiction.
Yeah, I love that. I have some points, but I love that last part, right? Like, if I ask you now, you know, how much Bitcoin do you have? Well, you will probably say I don't have enough, but you can say I don't have any, and then I say, well, John, I know you have Bitcoin, and then you say, no, I don't, and then what? You know, we're at a stalemate. You know, I cannot prove, I cannot prove that you have it. You can also not prove that you don't have it. So, like.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I could even send who's lying, right?
I could send it to my relative in a foreign country, really. And
I mean, I cannot guess your private key. So if I'm the tax person or the government person, and I say, well, John, I know you have Bitcoin, and they say, well, you know, I hit my head in a boating accident and then I lost it. You know, like there's no, you are sovereign. You can decide
absolutely
on that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the tremendous second order effects, I think, of Bitcoin adoption over time, is that we will start to see more self-sovereignty, personal agency, which I think is a wonderful trend. And it's a very sort of countervailing trend to what we have seen over the last like two or three decades, where unfortunately, like, we're sort of like that frog in the boiling pot, where there are increasing impositions on us from government to the point where it's now expected that every transaction has to be permissioned by the government, or that the government should know about everything. And I think this is it's a very powerful force to sort of counteract that over time, where we will see more self-sovereignty and personal agency in a way that we never would have without Bitcoin.
Yeah. And I also think the Russia example is good, right? Like, the whatever you think of it, you know, if they can do it to Russia, they can do it to you. You know, like,
absolutely.
I think that's more the point.
Exactly.
Yeah. And what you said about the neutrality, I think the neutrality is what makes it equal, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw a tweet I shared yesterday. Tomorrow I'm going to publish a little video about it. But if we are going to measure like human productivity in Bitcoin, then it will all, I'm still working on how to share it, but like, the neutrality of Bitcoin also makes it equal, right? If we expend the same amount of energy, you and I, you do it in Africa and I do it in Europe, you know, and we do we build the exact same thing, then how you are rewarded for that time and energy has a different value than how I'm rewarded. Also comparing these rewards with each other, which is not equal, right? Because we did the exact same work. It's just how we are rewarded, which,
absolutely,
you know, kills that balance, basically, that balance in the value exchange between the person who delivers a product or a service and the buyer. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a much more fair money versus the current system we have, where there are people in control. And when you mention Africa, I mean, of course, we know that, like, a country like France, I think there's maybe 11 or 12 countries in Africa that are still using the French CAF currency, whatever, which is,
that's not a rabbit hole. Currency or something like that. Yeah.
Crazy.
So it's like, based on the franc, which France doesn't use anymore for 23 years.
Right.
It's issued by France, right?
it's crazy. So they're definitely, yeah. Like France is definitely extracting a sort of a pound of flesh from that scenario. And I think when we move to the Bitcoin standard, then these African nations will have more sovereignty, and the individuals within those nations will have their more self-sovereignty as well.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And also what you said, you know, like fiat money is forced on you and Bitcoin is adopted by you, right? And
exactly.
What I see is that people don't like these hard words, right? When you say like, oh, this is money you are forced to use, and people think like, oh, that sounds crazy or whatever, like they're triggered, right? But it's real. Like did you ever, I mean, you grew up in Ireland and I also grew up in a Western European country. Like did you ever think about what is money? Like it just worked. You had coins, you went to the bakery, you got a bread, you're like, okay.
Exactly.
Apparently this is it. You know?
Exactly. I think one of the biggest challenges we face as Bitcoiners and talking to other people is the fact that the current money generally works. It sort of works. Like you go to the store and you can buy everything and every merchant will accept the money in that. I think there is a kind of a apathy that we have with our current money. But I think we certainly see in parts of the world like Zimbabwe and Argentina and so forth that certainly those people are well aware that the fiat money isn't working and doesn't work. And so they look for better solutions. And of course, in many of those countries, they look to the dollar because they're still sort of mired in that sort of fiat mindset. And the dollar is like the least dirty shirt in the dirty laundry in a way. But it's still very much suffering from the same debasement as all these other currencies. And structurally, there is essentially no difference. I mean, the only difference might be that the U.S. Is the reserve currency of the world, but that's just a sort of a flag or a moniker in some ways. And I think just like we've seen with every other reserve currency of the world, that position is likely to be usurped by Bitcoin. Yeah. By the next reserve.
Well, but I mean, that's also why we look at America, right? I had someone ask me last week, like, why do you tweet so much and talk so much about America and finance and stuff? And I said this, like, I don't live in America, but it's the same system. Everyone is basically forced to use it, especially like in international settlements, etc. And it doesn't really look that good, right? Like, and so of course I look at that because if America implodes, then we will have the effects here too, undoubtedly. You know, so it's as you said, it's the apex.
Yeah,
it's the apex currency right now. So yeah,
I think there's a related phrase. If the U.S. Sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. Something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so. If we move towards Bitcoin and you mentioned medium of exchange, you know, I think mainly, but yeah, I'd love to talk with you about that. Like I see it as, you know, I would say critics say things like the transaction speed and MasterCard, etc. But then they say, well, I thought, you know, Bitcoin was supposed to be money and now people are just hoarding it and they're storing it and they're talking about store value, etc. Right. Mm-hmm. And what I say is like, it can only be a medium of exchange if it is a store of value before, sure. Right? Like if I'm not incentivized to hold it, why would I want to earn it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I.e. exchange it, right? With someone else. But like how do you see this?
Yeah, it's a very big topic. Certainly money has three roles as a store of value, a medium of exchange, and a unit of account. And I think it's important to recognize that those three roles can't be divorced from each other. Like there should be no concept of one money that is a medium of exchange and another money that is a store of value. I think it's a kind of a ludicrous prospect, even though in the short term, I think that's a scenario arguably we have right now where you could say that, hey, many of us are, especially Bitcoiners, we're hodling and accumulating our Bitcoin and we're spending our fiat. I think a couple of important things to note there is that Bitcoiners who recognize the value of Bitcoin and are accumulating Bitcoin, really the reason that we're not spending it is really due down to artificial constructs, I would say, of taxable events. That because if we were in, say, El Salvador, there would be no reason not to spend Bitcoin, because you could just replace it with, even if you had fiat income, like you can do the kind of spend and replace strategy without any points of friction. There's no real incentive not to. I think that is really, really the most important reason. Like when people say that, like, hey, look, people aren't spending their Bitcoin, it's really because of that artificial construct. And that if we didn't have taxable events, we would see much more of a spend and replace strategy. And I think we would hope.
You mean like a sales tax or something, or just?
What I mean is that, like, say there's a local merchant who accepts Bitcoin, and I'm going to make a $100 purchase. I could go and make that equivalent $100 purchase in Bitcoin, and then buy an extra $100 of Bitcoin. And with that, then my Bitcoin stack is the same as it was before. So that's a kind of an example of it, like a spend and replace strategy, which I think some Bitcoiners are doing, but they would only do it if they have no tax consequences from doing that. The problem with me doing that in the United States right now, say living in California, is that, you know, anytime you do make anytime you do spend your Bitcoin, that is like selling a stock. You have to pay tax. Gotcha. You start to get hit with that. But in certain countries, like I think, for example, Germany and Portugal, if I'm not mistaken, if you hold Bitcoin for 1 year, there's no longer any taxable events associated with it. So then you overcome that. And I know that if I were in Germany, I'd be spending Bitcoin much more than I am now, because there would be no taxable events. Yeah. And like I touched on earlier, I think there a very key and profound and reason that's not discussed much, where I do see Bitcoin playing a role in medium of exchange, is the fact that it does strip out so many costs from the system. And I wrote that article about it. Have the Bitcoiner friendly strategy, how merchants can employ a Bitcoiner friendly strategy and really strip out a lot of costs from that payments channel. One of the key opportunities I do see, and this is where this is one of the reasons I'm kind of focused on Bitcoin in many ways, is that when I look at the experience and expertise I got at MasterCard in card linked offers, I see a huge opportunity for Bitcoin native offers to be a catalyst for driving Bitcoin as medium of exchange. And I wrote my most recent piece on that, the Bitcoin catalyst offers as the Bitcoin catalyst of merchant offers. I do see that as a tremendous opportunity. And I really look forward to working more on some strategies in that area. Because just to give a bit of an explanation, merchant offers is like card-linked offers in the fiat world is a very powerful marketing tool where you can incentivize consumers to go to certain merchants. And once they make a qualifying spend, which is spending a certain amount of money over a certain threshold in one or more visits in a certain period of time, then they get a reward. They get a statement credit back on their credit card or their debit card. And it's a very powerful way to for the merchant to spend their marketing budget versus other alternatives. But when you take that into the Bitcoin world, it almost puts it on steroids and it turbocharges it, because you're not only driving all of that loyalty behavior, that spend behavior, that repeat visits and higher baskets, basket size, and attracting new customers, but you're doing so on a low cost payments rail. So you're driving those consumers to the Bitcoin rails, which are far lower cost. And not only doing that for for that particular transaction, but potentially then generating that longer term behavior. So there's a lifetime value associated with that as well, not just higher loyalty from the consumers, from Bitcoiners, but also higher loyalty on those lower cost rails. So I think there's tremendous opportunity there.
Yeah. Are there any other things that merchants should consider when they decide to accept Bitcoin? I mean, for a lot sure. of people. It's a novelty, of course, and maybe there are sometimes customers that ask for it. I actually have my hairdresser now who accepts Bitcoin. Yeah. The first time I came to him, I paid him in Bitcoin, and now he has a sticker.
So very that's cool. Great. That's great.
But like, yeah, what are things I should consider?
Yeah, I think, well, look, for the kind of solutions that I hope to work on, I think a critical thing to note is that this is very much this opportunity around medium of exchange, in particular offers like Bitcoin native offers. It's a two-sided market. And that's where you have to not just get merchants to accept Bitcoin, but you also have to get an audience of Bitcoiners and drive those Bitcoiners to those merchants to make it a win-win for everybody. So that's definitely challenging. I mean, building a two-sided market business is always challenging. Like some examples would be more like Airbnb or Uber or eBay. You have to solve for both sides of the market. So for someone like me looking to drive that business and hopefully work with other Bitcoiners driving that that type of solution, we have to work on some strategies to build out both sides of that market. In terms of the merchant, I think another key part of their business, other than just accepting Bitcoin, there's obviously the related things like making sure there's sufficient liquidity and to make sure that all of the transactions come through without any friction. I think there's also very much a treasury strategy component, and I hope to write about that shortly. It's not a new idea, but the idea of there's two parts to that. One is just the custody part. So if you're a Bitcoin merchant and you're accepting Bitcoin and you have a Bitcoin channel opening up and you have Bitcoin coming in, the first problem to solve for is custody. But the second problem then is a more strategic view around, well, how do we manage that as a treasury reserve asset? And I think there's huge potential benefits there as well. I mean, just on that point, I think it was in maybe one of Preston Pish's podcast recently where he covered that some team did a analysis of if you held Bitcoin for a four-year period, and they did the analysis over the last 15 years, that the very worst day, if you picked the very worst day to start that four-year period, you would have a 24% compound annual growth rate, which is extraordinary. And I think the average is, you know, maybe closer to 100% or something like that. And of course, past results are no indication of future results disclosure. But it's still, it's a very powerful message to at least have Bitcoin as part of one's treasury.
So yeah, well, I see. I think it's Square who introduced it now, or Block.
That's right.
That you can just DCA from your revenue just straight into Bitcoin. Yeah, I think that's super interesting. Instead of the other way around, you know, that will come, I think, when people pay in Bitcoin, but now they pay in fiat and you just, you know, put X percent of your revenue just directly in Bitcoin. Fascinating chart also, the one you mentioned, right? I'm a big proponent of no trading and DCA slowly, although I'm all smash no DCA, but I saw the graph and super interesting approach. I never saw that before, and you know, you don't want to time the market. I think like that's the entire point, right? You just want to slowly build your stack, basically.
I agree. I certainly learned some tough lessons there as well. I went through my little trading phase as well. Many of us do.
Likewise. Never doing it again. No. So how do you see or think about it? And I think you briefly touched upon it, but kind of like the psychology of money, or what people think is money, how that influences their willingness to adopt Bitcoin as an actual alternative or a store of value.
Yeah, it's I definitely look forward to Bitcoin becoming more normalized. I think part of the challenge is that very few people are willing to put the work in to understand what is money and what makes a good money and why Bitcoin is better money and that. But I think if it gets to the point where it's normalized and they see their peers acquiring Bitcoin, and to your point, you just touched on, like in Square, when they have an option like, hey, do you want to keep 10% of your balance in Bitcoin, or when you or when you get paid, and I think there's one or two companies doing this, you can get paid in Bitcoin, and that when that starts to be an option, just like when you go to your 401k and you're asked like, hey, do you want which mutual funds do you want, or which bond portfolios do you want? Once Bitcoin is an option there, and I think we're starting to see that normalize with the ETFs, then you hopefully start to see people take a 5% allocation or a 10% allocation, and it just becomes increasingly normalized. But I think it may be a bridge too far to expect people to really dig into what is money and why it's a better money and so forth. They'll hopefully start to see it go up in value, and more people will probably start to realize, hey, maybe this is going to be the future of money, and maybe this fiat money is not going to be the future of money. So we'll see a transition, I think. And I don't know how long that transition is going to take and how steep that S-curve is going to be, but I think it will generally ratchet in one direction. And maybe one of the things we will see, which it's a theme I'm very excited about in the Bitcoin space, is concepts around game theory and jurisdictional competition, where we will see certain countries, like we saw with El Salvador, take a very significant step to make Bitcoin legal tender. And they're now having very significant growth and prosperity and foreign capital investment and tourism and much higher safety and security. And I know not all of that is due to Bitcoin, but I think we will start to see countries take that step to become more fertile ground and benign jurisdictions for Bitcoin, and they will show positive results. And that will then inspire other countries to have to do similar things. And we'll start to see that sort of virtuous circle. So I look forward to that.
Well, you see that already in America with the states, obviously, which is going to be interesting. I don't Absolutely. Think it's any similar than and I think Saylor mentioned it in his talk, right? Like why are the casinos in Nevada on the border of California, right?
Right.
So the people from California can come to the casino that was Absolutely. Not allowed in California. You know, so I think it's like that. And I'm thinking about what you just said about. If Jack Dorsey is listening, I think I just had an idea, but we want to show the opportunity that is there, you know, for people, for merchants in this case, to save in Bitcoin and to get value from this new money system, right? I think it would be interesting if at Square they could just give reports, right? Like if they say, well, would you want to put 10% of your revenue in Bitcoin? You know, 99 businesses around you are doing it. You know, collectively they've gained XYZ percent in purchasing power, right? Or similar businesses to you have done this and that, right? Like it's such a big opportunity to, actually help, you know, SMB businesses, I'd say.
Absolutely. I think one of the big catalysts there as well that's coming up is that I think by the start of next year, we have the FASB accounting changes coming in for Bitcoin, where currently Bitcoin is treated as a indefinite intangible from a accounting standpoint, which is very prohibitive to have Bitcoin on your books, because you have to account for it at its lowest value during the accounting period, which is just crazy. And we know that the I forget what FASB stands for, but it's the
international.
But it's very much an official accounting board, and I think they unanimously voted to change the accounting for Bitcoin to be just at its sort of market value, or I forget the exact term, but it's much more benign now and it's much more sensible. So it's no longer prohibitive to carry Bitcoin on your balance sheet. And of course, we'll probably start to see, you know, hopefully companies like Apple and Amazon and a lot of other public companies then just carry it on their balance sheet, and they won't need to get special permission, I think. Like
No, it's going to be in the standard, right? Like, so the, yeah. the FASB, it's the Financial Accounting Standards
yes.
Board, a private standard-setting yeah. body whose primary purpose is to establish and improve generally accepted accounting principles, right? So
yeah.
So you're allowed to follow that then.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's yeah. going to be very exciting. So I look forward to that. And of course, even though it it has a bit more of a American influence, a lot of countries in the world follow that. So I think mm-hmm. A lot of other countries will be following the same standard.
Yeah. So in the article we talk about, you also mentioned the concept of demonetization mm. and the shifting of monetary energy that's now stored in assets like real estate, stocks, collectibles, all these things yeah. like to Bitcoin. Can you share yeah. a bit about that?
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating. This also is a very large and long topic that's very interesting and worth digging into. It's really the concept that when we look, it's coming at this from first principles and stepping back, and you realize that the fiat money that we've had for the last, say, 40, 50 years, it's fundamentally broken because the rate of debasement of that money is so significant that we touched on the three roles of money earlier as a store of value, medium of exchange, and unit of account. Well, the very concept of, I guess a related point there is that money is used as savings as investment or consumption. That's another three kind of uses of money. But the very use of money as savings is really no longer available with fiat money, because even the interest rate that you get for a risk-free bond is really less than the rate of inflation, and that's even less than CPI. So the concept of savings in fiat does not exist anymore. And yeah. with that, it's forced people into either investment, the other two roles of money, investment or consumption. And in many cases, then it's forced them into what you would term malinvestment or malconsumption. Because savings is that's the default role of money, as savings no longer exists. So that's why we started to see money flow into what you might call investments that traditionally were never monetized. They were just valued at their use value. So if you go back to, say, like focusing on real estate, if you go back to the 18th century or even the 19th century, houses as a fraction of people's income. It might have been 2x somebody's income or 3x somebody's income. But now it's more like 10x or 11x somebody's income, the house, even though the actual physical nature of the house and the use value of that house hasn't changed. It's because yeah. Real estate has become monetized. So basically it's become the container for monetary energy or economic energy. And that's a role that real estate never played historically. And similarly for stocks, if you look at certain measures like price earnings ratio, just as an example, which is a typical sort of valuation metric for companies, we might have seen valuation price earning ratios before of, say, 10 to 15, and now it's maybe more like 45 to 50 or something like that, even though the fundamental nature of the business hasn't changed. So it's also become a container for monetary energy in a way that it never was historically. So with Bitcoin, we now have a money that is very much a savings technology, as we talked about it. So that role of money is now restored. And Bitcoin very much plays that role of savings and investment and consumption. And we will hopefully start to see a reversion away from malconsumption and malinvestment back to savings, because we have that sort of third leg of the stool playing its role again. So, so it's going to be interesting. And I don't know how long it's going to take, but it's a very big idea that tens of trillions of dollars of value in stocks and bonds and real estate and collectibles is going to start flooding into Bitcoin. But I think if you really think through from first principles, I think this is the reality that's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, 100% agree. I also think the third order effect would be that housing would become more affordable again.
I look forward to it.
Right. Yeah. There will be a lot of people that will go through real or psychological pain, you know, to get there. But yeah, no, I want to say no pain, no gain without pain. But I think like they also got a free ride in essence, right? Like they were lucky that they had these assets and other people wanted to, buy it from them, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, like nothing is free eventually. But yeah, I find it interesting what you said about like, and I agree, I think Bitcoin is a savings technology, right? It's not an investment. And so people, of course, in the media, they frame it as an investment. Oh, you can get rich, et cetera. But it's really about not getting poor, so it's a savings technology and it's not an investment. And the fact that people look at it as an investment, based on what you just said, I think shows us already how far gone we are with the value of the fiat money, right? The entire concept of saving is, well, in my country, that's really like drilled into you, right? Mm-hmm. In the youth. So I think a lot of people still save without actually thinking if that is the right thing to do. So I think in my country, it's one of the highest savings percentages, right?
Interesting.
But a lot of people, especially younger people, it's all about investing, etc. And so that's become like a thing, right? And you see eToro and Plus 500 and whatever, you know, like you have all these platforms basically. But it also takes time and you need to study, right? And you're spending your energy and time to figure this out. Well, you know, if you could just save without worrying, you could actually spend your time and energy on, you know, whatever you want to contribute to the world, right? And I think that's, you know, what Save Dean obviously talks about a lot with the high and low time preference.
Absolutely. But, I think on that point, Saylor made the point once that he used the term, like our fiat money is like a cattle prod that is constantly prodding people to invest or spend. And that's why we get this sort of malinvestment and malconsumption. So, by restoring the concept of savings, we no longer have to do that. We have this sort of default position for money as savings, and only then do we determine like, oh, do we have an investment opportunity that we're interested in that we need to take advantage of, or is there something that I need to spend money on? Yeah, right. Or do I need to spend money on something? Yeah. But right now, of course, you sort of feel like you have to spend money on something, especially if you live in countries like, say, Argentina, or that has high inflation, or Venezuela, you sort of have to get rid of your money, which is crazy. Yeah.
Well, if you follow the cattle prod idea, like it occupies your mind, right? A third party forces you to create a money, and you think, okay, I'm gonna use the money. And as a child, you have the money in your hand, and you get the bread, and you think, okay, well, this is the money. Right. But then when you grow up and you start to figure out, you know, what am I going to contribute to society? You need some time to figure that out. You know, most people don't know what they are good at. Right. But you are kind of like robbed of that opportunity to figure that out, because once you start earning money and start expanding your lifestyle, or you're moving out of the house, or then you're buying a house, or you get a relationship and a child and a car and a this and a that, like you trap yourself more in this system that keeps you busy with something that you shouldn't be busy with, basically.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And it's fascinating. I when we talk about this, right, and we talk through it, I'm just so surprised and shocked at the same time that not more people are thinking about this, right? And that's also why I think this conversation is a very practical conversation, right? But I have a lot of other conversations that are more about kind of like the spirituality or the personal development part, you know, the personal journey of discovering Bitcoin, because you have to in some way like run into this problem that I just described, and you have to get to maybe just one point where you think like, what am I doing, right? And that's kind of the start of hopefully the rabbit hole, if you're intellectually curious.
Exactly.
Or actually, you know, experience the problem of fiat money in a real hard way. Like, I just realized when I recorded in my my last podcast with Maya from Suriname, that the people in Suriname who make $180 a month and are on survival mode, they have no time to figure this out. So we are very lucky that
we
figured this out, you know.
Very true.
And that's also why we need to talk about it more. And so I think you explained a lot of different touch points, I think, very well. And I think terrific conversation for people to check out. I wanted to ask you the last question that I ask everyone. And that is, what is a core belief that you will never let go?
Yeah, I think maybe there's two here, especially as they relate to Bitcoin. One is to think from first principles. And I think this naturally comes to Bitcoiners, like we touched on earlier, where we have this intellectual curiosity. It's important to always ask why and why and why. And I think there's a framework out there. I think it's called the Five Whys framework. And it's very, very useful for really thinking through that. And I think that is very much the kind of mindset that allowed me to discover Bitcoin. And I think it's very important for anyone else to discover why Bitcoin is important. And maybe another belief that I hold is around recognizing artificial constructs, which we also touched on earlier, is the idea that people say dismiss Bitcoin as medium of exchange because they see certain things that are obstacles in the path. But when those obstacles are artificial constructs that can be removed and will be removed, I think, by certain governments, then the opportunity presents itself. So I think it's important to recognize what are natural obstacles versus artificial obstacles. And just as an example there's one from history. I think Andreas Antonopoulos maybe covered it in one of his talks or book, this concept of the red flag law, where in England, I think in the early parts of the 19th century, they had a very significant lead in car manufacturing. They had a lot of car companies. They had a lot of wonderful entrepreneurs and technology. But then they brought in this rule where because there were a number of accidents, somebody had to walk in front of the car with a red flag and wave people away. So, of course, this limited the car's speed and practicality and everything. It was a nightmare. But that was the reason then that the industries all moved to the US and the US took over the lead in car manufacturing. But that's very much an example of an artificial construct that got in the way. And I recommend, you know, just people be aware of those artificial constructs and make the distinction between artificial versus real.
Yeah, I love that. Thanks so much for sharing that. I would add to that the fact that they moved to America because they had open arms and then they profited from that, right? There's multiple examples of that in history, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's Bitcoin, what we're going to see.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Bitcoin is just a wonderful opportunity for that jurisdictional competition and game theory, because I think even in the case of that example of like auto manufacturing, there are probably just a handful of countries where auto manufacturing could have moved to, and US was certainly one of them. But in the case of Bitcoin, the jurisdictional competition is much broader. It's the whole world. And we will start to see more countries just raise their hand and say, hey, we just want to be Bitcoin friendly. And in many cases, what's important to note as well is that the country doesn't have to do anything particularly special to become Bitcoin or Bitcoin friendly. They just need to remove the obstacles that are there by default. Things like capital gains tax on Bitcoin or treating Bitcoin as property instead of currency. Just a few things like that, just to remove obstacles. It's about removing as opposed to adding new things.
Yeah. Well, I think there's never been any country who didn't profit from a adopting a technological advancement, right? So, absolutely. Anyone listening who leads a country, let's go.
Exactly.
Well, John, thanks again. Really enjoyed this conversation. And
thanks, Bram.
Yeah, looking forward to your new publications. And stay in
touch. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks. Take care.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, it would be amazing if you could rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. It will help us educate more millennials on the importance of Bitcoin. You can follow and connect with me on Twitter. I'm Bram K. That's @BRAMK. And if you are or know someone who has an interesting perspective on Bitcoin that's worth sharing, hit me up. I read and reply to every single message. I appreciate your support and hope you'll be here for the next episode. Thanks for listening. Bye.